360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
Good morning and welcome to The Week That Was, now proudly brought to you by De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers. And joining us in the studio this morning for The Week That Was, well, we have got the Deputy Opposition Leader, Gerard Mailey. Good morning.
Good morning, Katie. Good morning, listeners.
We've got Selena Ubo, the Attorney General of the Northern Territory. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning, Katie, and good morning to all your listeners.
We've got Maddie Hepworth, our very own news director.
Yeah, morning, Katie. Morning, all.
Morning.
Now, there's been honestly so much to cover off on this week. It's been an incredibly busy one, but I do just want to start very quickly with the vaccine rollout and some of the issues that we are experiencing at the moment. A 48-year-old Australian woman has died after developing blood clots following a COVID vaccine. Now, officials were last night scrambling to determine if the clots and death of the woman from Lake Macquarie in New South Wales were linked to her vaccination. She is understood to have received the AstraZeneca jab. Now, the New South Wales Health Department have confirmed the death, but said no link to the vaccine had been proven. The woman has received the vaccination. That was on April 9, is what is being reported. She passed away 5 days later after being admitted to intensive care in John Hunter Hospital and developing blood clotting. Now, earlier this week, there were calls from the Senator for the Northern Territory, Dr. Sam McMahon. She called on the Gunner Labor government to halt the AstraZeneca vaccine for people under the age of 50. Now, I think to myself, and I know we've spoken about this all throughout the week, but I really think that when it comes to the advice of the vaccine, we have to listen to the experts.
Yeah, look, Katie, that's my view as well. We've got a national body of experts who have been studying this vaccine and COVID-19 for the last year. They would know all the correct information. What I strongly advise people not to go on the internet and Google and do their own research. These health experts are experts. They know what they're doing and we need to listen to what their advice is. And I hope that the Labor government do that. And I'm sure they will, because really it's all about saving Territorians and saving Australians.
Absolutely, Katie. We are taking the expert advice. And I do really feel for our health practitioners and our frontline workers who are doing their best in such an uncertain and anxious time for all Australians, but particularly here in the Northern Territory. We also have to deal with the challenges of remote delivery. The Territory is so diverse. We have small pockets of people all across the Territory in very remote and rural locations. So being able to provide that information is number one, so that people can ask the questions they need to. What relates to themselves and their families is really important. But taking that expert advice is critical.
I know when we caught up with the Health Minister, Natasha Files, earlier in the week, we did speak about the situation, obviously, with the AstraZeneca jab, but we also discussed the Pfizer vaccine. And I know that there has been some changes to the way in which it can be stored now, because to begin with, it was certainly a situation where it had to be stored at incredibly low temperatures for quite an extended period of time. But I had asked her whether these changes were going to mean that there'd be a delay in the rollout of the vaccine to remote communities. I mean, I know you've got some remote communities in your electorate. Selena, are you concerned about that?
This is something myself and other members of my team who represent remote regions of the Northern Territory have been speaking very regularly and routinely with Minister Files and the information. Again, this is very new for everyone, so we can only take the information at the time. It does change quite frequently, as we've just seen in literally the last week. More information is coming to light. But again, that communication is really important. How are you communicating that to remote Territorians, and particularly Aboriginal Territorians who have First Nation language as their first, second and third language, and English might be further down the line. So that's really important, getting that messaging and communication across. But ultimately, we want to make sure that we have people who are vaccinated and that it is safe to vaccinate and that we're able to protect our remote Territorians.
It does seem like the longer the vaccine rollout goes on, the more it is becoming politicised. And even though, you know, all political leaders are saying, you know, we need to listen to the health advice, we're seeing different opinions from different state leaders, premiers, chief ministers, as opposed to what the federal health advice is, and the back and forth between the vaccine numbers and the availability and how much states are being allocated. But at the end of the day, it does, as everyone keeps saying, comes back to that official health advice. So I think the lines are starting to become a little bit blurred now between what is official health advice and what is an opinion of a premier or a chief minister, or in the case earlier this week with Senator Sam McMahon going, well, I believe this should be the way now. And it seems that we're hearing from voices of authorities about the vaccine rollout. And like I said, that line between what is that official health advice or is that political commentary now? And I feel like the longer it goes on, it is becoming more blurred.
Well, and we've got to be so careful of that. I mean, at the end of the day, we do need to make sure that we are taking the advice of our health professionals. I know here in the Northern Territory, Dr. Hugh Heggie, I'm sure, does not, you know, he does not make these decisions lightly. There is a lot of thought that goes into the vaccine rollout and various other things, and we've got to all make sure that we do adhere to that advice, I think.
And we're very lucky in Australia because we don't have any community transmission. You know, I really feel out for some of the nations around the world, like America or India or UK. Where there's people dying daily and it's spreading out of control. We are lucky we don't have it, so we really can take the time to make sure we get it right, because what we don't want is to inject people and someone dying or multiple people dying. So we are in a very, very good situation that we don't have to rush.
We certainly are. Now let's move along, and we have spoken so much on this show about the issues that we're experiencing with youth crime, and a report in the Australian newspaper yesterday suggested that moves are being made by attorney generals around the nation to raise the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 12. The Australian newspaper reported the growing consensus among states to adopt the change, and it was, of course, revealed on the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody report. It's part of a move to lower Indigenous incarceration rates, particularly among youth. Now, this draft report, which was commissioned by a meeting of Attorney Generals in July last year, has recommended that all governments raise the age of criminal responsibility to 14. The report has yet to be publicly released. However, it offers an alternative to raising the age to 14 with exceptions for serious crimes. It also recommends, if neither of those two options is agreed to, the age threshold be raised to 12 with the minimum age of detention fixed to 14. Minister, you are our Attorney General here in the Northern Territory. Are we going to be raising the age of criminal responsibility to 14?
Katie, we have committed through the findings and the recommendations of the Royal Commission to raise the age of criminal responsibility to 12 here in the Northern Territory. And as you mentioned, on a national scale, there are conversations across all jurisdictions, and particularly with the meeting of Attorney Generals. Our last one was 2 weeks ago with our new Federal Attorney General, Senator Michaela Cash. That conversation is ongoing. There are jurisdictions that are looking at what their commitments are. We're absolutely committed here in the Territory raising it to 12 years of age, and then we'll be following some of the other jurisdictions in regards to those conversations to see what's happening in other parts of the country.
What's the time frame on that? I mean, when are we anticipating that that's going to happen?
I can't give you a time frame off the top of my head because it's actually sitting with my colleague, the Minister for Territory Family. She's responsible for the Youth Justice Act. That's Kate Warden. But working closely with her, my department, Attorney Generals and Justice, in regards to any legislative change. So I can't quote a time frame. I just don't want to give the incorrect information.
We had quite an extensive interview with the Minister for Territory Families yesterday, Kate Warden, and she said there is no rush, that we are keeping an eye on what is happening interstate and seeing what some of those other states, but indeed what happens nationally. And I think that, you know, that's probably a good thing to do, to see how things roll out nationally. But we are very unique here in the Northern Territory. There is no doubt about that. Obviously, our Indigenous population is much greater than it is in other states and territories. Our incarceration rate of Indigenous people is also much greater, as I understand it, than other locations. But we've got a real issue at the moment in the Territory with youth crime, and we are making, there are going to be these changes to the legislation in May, so next month. There's calls from the community for that to happen sooner, and I know that that's something that the CLP was pushing for earlier in the week, Jared.
Yeah, look, ultimately, remember, the criminal code says that a child between 10 and 14 is not criminally responsible unless they know their conduct is wrong. So there's already that space in the legislation, and the prosecution, if they have the onus to prove that. So it's not the defendant, it's the prosecution who've got to prove. So if you've got a child who may be 11, who maybe have some sort of intellectual disability or some sort of out there and doesn't know that's wrong, well, that's already covered in our legislation. So, but if you've got a 10 or 12 or 13-year-old who does it wrong, who repeat offender, who they know they're doing the wrong thing, they're the ones that then should be punished. Because remember, the people out there in the community are sick and tired of people breaking into their houses, breaking into their businesses, stealing their cars, just mindless damage for a pack of cigarettes or $10.
So do you reckon keep it the same, Jared? Keep it at the 10?
Keep it the same. Our legislation already covers that space we're talking about. And let's focus on stopping crime and reducing crime rates and stopping people feeling unsafe in their own home, their own businesses, because that's where the issue is right now.
Where do you reckon this is all going to land with the legislation that's coming in May? I know that that obviously the CLP earlier in the week had called for Parliament to be recalled for a day to get that legislation moving sooner rather than later. It does sound as though that's not going to happen, that we are going to see these legislative changes come in or be introduced in May. But whether that actually gets across the line in those 2 weeks of sittings at the beginning of May remains to be seen. I mean, is that your intention, Selena?
Katie, it's really important that listeners and Territorians understand that legislation does take time to do properly. It's a very highly skilled and talented, critical piece of work that we need to have. When we are working on legislative changes, it is very skilled and it does take time, physical time. So when we're changing policies, when we're changing legislation and obviously having these conversations, when we politicise it or not, ultimately the fact is, it still takes time to make those legislative changes. So we want to make sure that what we're doing here in the Territory is effective, it's suitable, it reflects community needs and aspirations, but also it's done properly. I think we have run into much more danger when we hasten decisions, when we do things on the fly, when there are knee-jerk reaction like the CLP likes to do, and we see the devastating effects years later of having to unpick that very rushed legislation.
But
it's not effective.
They have been in power for the last almost 5 years now, and there's plenty of time to change it. The crime has been escalating not just in the last week or the last month, over the last year or so. So there's been plenty of time, and you might say we need time too, but look at the Dan Murphy legislation. They had all the time in the world, and now that's back in court. So that's even making it even more confusing in relation to the legislation. So our legislation was very simple. It had two main points. It was 6 pages long to about changing the presumption. Because remember, Kate Warden yesterday got it all wrong, saying, oh, if you fiddle with your bracelet, that's a breach of bail. Yep. They took that out, so that's not even correct.
So you're saying it's not an offence, or it's not...
Remember, the Labor government changed the law and decriminalised breach of bail. So if you breach your bail, that's not an offence you get charged with now.
Katie, when we're looking at
so what
we're trying to do
example of
in
Labor
the long term,
not understanding their own legislation.
Again, not trying to rush like the CLP tends to do. We are looking at more than just one issue. We're looking at the root causes of crime. How can we stop crime if we're not understanding the reasons for it? We're looking at preventing crime, but also reducing
contact for young people with the justice system. I mean, one of the points, though, that Jared makes, I think is a very important one, that this is not a new issue. This is something that's been going on for some time. We've been talking about it over such an extended period on this show. I do want to take you, though, to a report in the Northern Territory News, which says one of the teenagers charged with allegedly breaking into the Fanny Bay IGA last week has been granted bail. The 16-year-old who cannot be named again faced the Youth Justice Court on Thursday, where his lawyer successfully applied for him to be let out of Don Dale. Now, the lawyer said that the boy acknowledged his issues with alcohol had caused him to do, in his words, stupid things in the past, and he now wanted to address them. His lawyer said that he would have very limited access to alcohol services inside the detention centre with the current issues getting in and out of that facility. The slow but steady work towards his own recognition of his needs and working towards addressing those needs is something that could really be interrupted due to the difficulties faced by the Don Dale facility at the moment. Now, I know that there's going to be people listening to the show this morning who think, well, goodness me, is this all that is wrong at the moment, where we have got people who are breaking the law, doing the wrong thing, and then they are bailed?
So this youth has been given bail because Don Dale isn't being managed correctly. That's my reading of that legislation. So they're either understaffed or whatever. And so from my understanding is that the lawyers and Territory families can't get in to see these detainees. So that really shows that Labor can't even handle the Don Dale Centre. These children are out there committing crimes. They're not there just there for stealing a bag of lollies. You know, it's really easy to get bail as a youth offender. The bail is granted, but going to Don Dale is the last resort. You know, I don't know what the history of these people are, but my guess is they would be multiple repeat offenders, there would be breaches of bail, there would be, there's all sorts of reasons why they're there. So that they don't just get put there straight away. So they're the serious offenders who are, if they aren't there, they're out breaking into people's houses. And people, it's time to start thinking about the victims here, the people who live in their homes, their businesses, and their cars that get stolen and can't go to work. When a tradie's youth gets gets stolen, that's it. They can't work for a week.
But it's also, like, to me, it also identifies the other issue that we've got, is that we've got to make sure, you know, we talk so much about making sure that we've got these wraparound services as well for young people, so that then, if they do the wrong thing, that we're able to help them to become rehabilitated. You know, to me, if we've got a 16-year-old who's got issues with alcohol and they're not able to be addressed, and they're not able to sort of be helped while they're inside Dondale, does that actually demonstrate that we don't have the programs that we need inside that centre to rehabilitate people?
Exactly right, Katie Wolfe.
Katie, we're looking at making sure that whatever services are there to support a young person or even an adult who is in the corrective system, that those programs and those measures are effective. Number one, to reduce any of those health issues that may be substance abuse, etc., which may then cause some of those criminal activities. But number two, making sure that we reduce recidivism, so reduce the rate of reoffending. And we're not going to do that if there's the big stick approach in terms of locking up and throwing away the key. There has to be those opportunities for rehabilitation, but also those pathways out. If you're being, you're going through a rehabilitation program, what's the outset at the end of that program? Is it an employment pathway? Is it a training pathway? Is it back into education? So looking at those really complex issues and measures, one, the root of crime, two, rehabilitation and reducing reoffending, but then also what is the opportunities for that young person post their consequence and sentence, but also that program when they've completed it.
We're not talking about the big stick, lock them up, throw away the key. We're putting youth into Dondale, and then while they're in Dondale, that's when they can then should be available to the facilities for rehabilitation, for drug, alcohol, to go to school, to learn about life, learn about managing a budget. If they can't do it in Dondale, the chance of doing it outside in a supportive bail or someone's home or back at their own home, their bail for that would be very difficult.
Katie,
so if they can't do it in Dondale, they can't do it outside.
The
so these children need help. They're not there for stealing
program.
A bag of lollies. They need some help, and it's time the government do that, because it's really about trying to start thinking about the victim. I always go back to, imagine what it's like when your house gets broken into, and they're walking around in your house, in your own business, and there's thousands of dollars worth of damage. That's where these people are forgotten. It's the victims that are forgotten.
I think it's going to be a hard sell, raising the age of criminal responsibility nationally up to 14, but even more so here in the Northern Territory when we look at what is perceived as a youth crime crisis at the moment as well. I think you raised a good point as well, that if we were to raise that, then the issues that associated with youth crime, like this young fella who acknowledged his issues with alcohol, no doubt there would be 14-year-olds dealing, with the same issue as well. So I guess, and it's something that the legislation would then have to look at, if we're going to raise the age of criminal responsibility, I guess there would have to be a greater emphasis on those support services. Because, I mean, and Selena or Jared, you might be able to answer, what happens if you've got a young offender with a string of offences, an 11-year-old, and we raise the age of criminal responsibility to 12, what happens if they are caught, committing a string of offences? Obviously, there's no criminal charge, but I imagine there would then have to be a lot of support services if they're not going to have any charges against them.
Well, you're right, Matt, and when we're talking about sentencing options, and it's quite restricted and limited at this point in time, so that's why that bigger picture work is happening, and particularly the work of Territory Families. And I think it is quite rude for Deputy Opposition Leader to say that Dondale and people aren't working properly there. I think that's a slap in the face.
That's what the news
says. People are doing a very, very hard job under very, very trying and complex circumstances to try and support not just one young people actually facing the consequences for things that they've done wrong, but also two, trying to reduce the constant cycle of contact into the justice system that some of these young people have, particularly those repeat offenders. How can we break that cycle? That's what Labor government's about, Katie. That's what we're looking at, trying to reduce in the long term so we can have those safer communities.
I
and
did
those
just get a message from one of our listeners that said, what about Manuel, whose shop was broken into?
Well, that's what I always say. And with all due respect, if you're, like Maddie's example, if you're 11 and it's 12, you wouldn't even be sentencing. There wouldn't even be sentencing because you're not going to get charged. So you've got it wrong to start with. It's not a sentencing option because you're not going to get charged if you're only 11. So we need to do it. And if you've got an 11-year-old, how are you going to get that person and force them to go and do some sort of rehab if you can't force them? If they've got their own choice to do it and they don't do it, how can you force them? So you need that guidance. And if they're not criminally responsible, they're not going to be a sentencing option because they're not going to be charged.
360's The Week That Was.
Thanks to the Silver Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was, and joining us in the studio this morning, we've got Jared Maley, Selena Ubo and Maddie Hepworth. Now, I want to go to a story which is being reported in the Northern Territory News today, and that is the Northern Territory's hospitality industry is 7,000 workers short ahead of what will most likely be one of the busiest tourist seasons ever. The widespread worker crisis comes despite the Territory experiencing the biggest jump in the unemployment rate of any Australian jurisdiction. That's according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics data, which was released for the month of March. But a survey of Hospitality NT's members has found that 97% of businesses are facing a labour shortage crisis. It is the only issue every one of our businesses is talking about, is what Alex Bruce, the CEO of Hospitality NT, has told the paper. We're going to catch up with Alex Bruce a little bit later on the show, but I do just want to play for you all a bit of a discussion that I'd actually had with Daniel Rochford, the CEO of Tourism Central Australia, yesterday. Take a listen to what he had to say.
We're at a situation where, as we've gone from nothing to no vacancy, we just don't have the staff, Katie. I have done a bit of a back-of-the-envelope estimation, having spoken to many of our GMs and many of our tourism operators. We're looking for over 200-plus employees right here, right now in the Red Centre.
Wow. How are you going to get those kind of numbers?
Well, our operators are absolutely scrambling and they're really struggling to get people to come to the Red Centre at the moment. This is creating a lot of challenges for our sector. You know, having gone through the pandemic, now things are starting to pick up. We're facing this next challenge. So here's a great opportunity for economic development for Central Australia right here, right now, by having some sort of support to encourage employees to come to Central Australia. And we know it's Hospitality NT has been really proactive around this, and we certainly support there in this initiative.
So there's no doubt that this is going to be a big issue, I think, for our hospitality industry, also for our tourism industry. I mean, how do we fill these kind of jobs? Because we saw that support, that government support for our farmers, the melon pickers. But how do we support, you know, the tourism industry?
So this is a real chance for the Labor government to show some leadership and fix this. They can't say they're going to be a surprise, because we knew that COVID happened last year and we knew that it's going to go away and the vaccine's in and this is going to be an issue. It's going to be a tourist market for nationally. People are going to come to the Northern Territory in the dry season more than normal. So it's really an opportunity for Labor to step up now and show that they've bring in the programs and give the support to these people and give initiative and support for these people to come to the Territory and stay here. And unfortunately, they come and they get the victims of crime, so it's a balance. But this is a real test for Labor government. So I really hope they do for the Territory, because it's a real opportunity here to grow our economy, grow our population. And remember the old story, people used to come, I've come for a working holiday and next minute I've stayed here.
Yeah, that's what we want to happen.
It happened a long time ago, but that seemed to have dropped off. I don't hear many people saying that now. So this is a real test of Michael Gunn as leadership to fix this problem, come in, show some leadership and get these people
to come
to
the Territory. What do you reckon, Jared? Time to dust off the old Boundless Possible campaign.
we don't want to waste the money, that's for
boundless
sure.
Boundless Possible, Katie, I like it. But Katie, this is a good problem to have, but nonetheless it is a problem that we are facing, and I've just spent the last 3 days down in Alice Springs and it is going off. It is so great to see hundreds of tourists, particularly with the Parchima Light Festival, which is going, but school holidays as well. And as we heard from Daniel, and I was able and fortunate enough to meet with Tourism Central Australia, they are having this issue, and it is a real issue, but it is a positive issue to have, because we can work through some of the ways we can support our tourism operators in getting some of those workers to Central Australia. One of the areas where we have to acknowledge where we have been highly affected by COVID-19 in the Territory is we've been quite reliant for years and years and years on seasonal workers and backpackers. We haven't been able to utilise those workers in this time period because the world's changed and we're still coming out of that. But the positive thing, particularly for Central Australia, is we're seeing those tourists return. We're seeing families from the top end, and I saw lots of Darwin people and people from Katherine, which is where I live, going down to enjoy enjoy Parchima with their family. So that is a positive thing for Central Australia, but we need to ensure that we continue to work and support those tourism operators.
Do you reckon, though, that we do need to try? Alex Bruce has told the paper, or he's urging the Northern Territory Government to consider a funding package to lure some of those seasonal workers from around Australia to spend their winter months in the Territory. I mean, is this something that we do need to try to do? I know that, that there'd been that funding announcement, obviously, for the melon farmers. But do we need to try and do something like this to get people here?
Absolutely, Katie. We need to get people here because this is a classic example. This is a real opportunity to grow our economy and grow our population and get these people to come up, enjoy our lifestyle and then stay here. So it's really on the Labor government to do some programs, do some funding, put the support in, because it's not a surprise. They can't come later in June and say, oh, we didn't know, we had not enough time. They've had all year. They know this is going to happen. It's time to fix it. So it's a good opportunity for some leadership, and fingers crossed it happens, because I really want the Territory to go ahead.
Katie, our Tourism Minister, Natasha Files, has spent nearly a week in Central Australia, so she's been meeting and she's been seeing for herself the positive increase in tourism in Central Australia, and meeting with those operators and with Tourism Central Australia as well. So I'm sure she will be talking with those members from TCA about ways we can support as government. They're the industry experts. They have some really great ideas and solutions. Daniel and I also met with Patrick from TCA, came up with some really constructive ways of how they think that things can be supported better.
It's not just going to be Central Australia, though, is it? It's going to be right across the place.
Yeah, absolutely, Katie. Like I said, I live in Katherine, and we didn't have a downward spike in our traditional wet season low period. We saw so many people from across the Territory travelling in November, December, January, which is traditionally a quiet time for Katherine. It was pretty hard to get car spaces at some of our most popular restaurants and even some of our bookings with our hotels and motels in Katherine, which is, again, a good story, but now it's going to increase. And again, it's about identifying where those areas of support can be put in place, talking also with other jurisdictions to see what they're doing in terms of dealing with some of the influx of tourism because of the seasons and the changes. And we know that the dry season, the winter season here in the Territory, is the most popular time to visit. So very happy to look at constructive ways forward and support the tourism industry in
the
Territory.
So this is a great opportunity to get our unemployment rate down. There's people here in the Territory who are looking for work, haven't got work, they need to be matched into those jobs, and this is an opportunity for the government to make those pathways clear, broad and easy to go down, so people transition from unemployed or transition from a job where they don't like, or for whatever reason, to a new job, a new industry, and young people coming out of school, coming out of uni. There's great opportunity, and the government really got to open that pathway and make it bright, shiny light so people come and work there and stay here.
And we do know, I mean, the Northern Territory we're the worst jurisdiction for jobs growth in Australia in the month of March. So this new data, obviously released on Thursday, has shown that that the Northern Territory has the highest proportion of people working, with our participation rate at 72.7%, well above the national average of 66%. But the figures are, the Territory did see a 1.2% decline in the number of employed people in the 3 months to March 2021. That's what the new Australian Bureau of Statistics data have shown. The disappointing result is apparently at odds with the Australia-wide figure, which saw the number of jobs grow 0.5%. CommSec Chief Economist Craig James has said that monthly data could be erratic, but said the Northern Territory's result was at odds with a spectacular national result. So I guess it's, maybe there is a real opportunity here for us, and I don't know. You know, there's smarter brains than mine thinking about how we're able to sort of capitalise on the issues that we've got within tourism and hospitality, and trying to fill those positions and trying to hopefully boost the population.
Because the government's got a whole public service, 20-odd thousand people there who work hard, and their job is to go away and listen and make those programs and give ideas to the government, to the ministers, so they can make decisions. Now's a perfect opportunity to harness all those public service to work out, get some programs, get some support, get these young children who are out of school or just out of uni, or who are at uni looking for part-time work right across the Territory. Because, and as well, people from interstate, they have, you go to uni, get 12 weeks holiday a year, and 4 weeks in mid-year when you could come to the Northern Territory, you could work, earn some good money and experience a great lifestyle. And who knows what might happen? You might meet a new partner, you might stay here, because it's all about growing our population and growing our economy.
Sounds like a romance novel.
Hey, it does, doesn't it? 360's
the the week that was. Thanks to De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers.
Well, you are listening to The Week That Was. Jared Maley, Selena Rubo and Maddie Hepworth in the studio with us. And we learned earlier in the week, in an email obtained by the Northern Territory News, that the Territory's COVID-19 rental measures have been extended. That is despite, well, yourself, Selena, being told that they were no longer necessary by the Northern Territory's peak real estate body. Now, we caught up with Quinton Killian from the Real Estate Institute of the Northern Territory a bit earlier in the week, but he told members, so basically in this email, which was obtained by the paper, members, well, decided, they were told that that you'd decided not to repeal the Residential Tenancies COVID-19 Modification Notice of 2020, instead leaving it in place to align with the Declaration of Public Health Emergency, which was extended until June 21 this year. Now, the notice gives tenants 60 days' notice to leave a property for both fixed term and periodic tenancy agreements. Now, normal protocol is, of course, 14 days for fixed term agreements and 42 for periodic tenancies. Minister, why did you decide to keep this measure in place despite the advice from the Real Estate Institute?
Katie, we were always looking at what the measures were to ensure that we were protecting and assisting Territorians. So this was one of the areas with the modification notice of the Rental Tenancies Act. It was originally designed to align with the Public Health Emergency Declaration, which of course is still in place. We are open to looking at any of those changes based on advice and seeing what's happening in the Northern Territory rental market. It's actually been amended three times already to look at returning it to its pre-pandemic framework. So it is an area that we're very aware of is changing again, at how we see the Territory coming back as a comeback capital. We are seeing those a very strong rental market. We're seeing a very strong retail housing market as well. But again, the challenge of balancing the needs of Territorians, whether they're landlords or tenants, is the job of government, and that's what we're focused on.
In other states, though, they have stopped this, haven't they? I mean, they've gone down the path of returning things back to normal. So I guess I'm just trying to understand why we would be different here in the Northern Territory if we are indeed the comeback capital.
Well, we obviously know the Territory is very unique in our circumstances, but also the Territorians who are living here, and making sure, again, that the balance between landlords and tenants is something that we represent as government. We are looking at what each jurisdiction has done and what the triggers are to change if they have done that in regards to any of their modification notices for their Rental Tenancy Acts. Again, something we're open to, but we're looking at making sure it's done properly. And it has been a gradual return to pre-pandemic framework. So continuing that work. And I met with Quinton last week, and that was very helpful to hear from his membership. And it's, again, we're just doing some research to make sure that we're doing things in a way that's balanced and measured for all Territorians.
I get that, but I also, I suppose, think to myself that Territorians are also landlords. And, you know, a lot of us are also juggling those mortgages and you know, trying to make sure that we've got good tenants. So I just, you know, sort of trying to understand things from both sides of the fence.
Definitely,
and remember,
Katie, wanted to say we're only going to see some of the impact with the JobKeeper finishing at the end of March. Obviously, we're in the third week of April now.
Yep.
So also seeing what are any of the impacts for Territorians being experienced because of the end of JobKeeper and looking at that. It's a bit too early to tell. We're only 3 weeks since the change from the federal scheme, but we want to make sure that Territorians are protected here as
well. Give it a couple of weeks.
Again, continuing to look at it, we'll take advice. We'll do some research. I've got my department looking at what other jurisdictions are doing, as you've mentioned, and we're very keen to make sure that we're keeping up with what's needed in the Territory.
Because in my view, we need to be careful here, because people are out there Australia-wide looking to invest, and people come up here to buy a rental property. And like, this is testing my memory here, my lawyer memory, but to put the 14 days, you've got to have like no rent for, I think it's 100 odd days or 120 days in itself before you can actually get an eviction notice. And you put that out to another 120 days, so that's like 240 days.
Yeah, it's an awfully long time for
someone not paying the rent. And remember, if your tenants don't pay the rent, the bank aren't going to go, oh, don't worry about it. You as a landlord have got to pay that for that whole period of time. So it's 60 costing
days in the territory.
Is it 60 days?
The modification notice.
But I mean, like,
so that's
you're
a long
right.
time. And so people are up here trying to, we're trying to be the comeback capital, and there's investors down south wanting to spend their money, and our prices are going up, our population, our tourism might be going up. So this is a great opportunity to invest, and people are going to be thinking, well, should I invest in the territory? Should I invest in Queensland or New South Wales or WA? And that investors look at those things to make sure, because we're not linked to the...
I actually think sometimes there's this real misconception that all, you know, that all investors or all landlords are like these really wealthy people with 20 mortgages and, you know, they're fine to pay it all off. It's actually not. Like, a lot of the time it's mum and dad investors that are trying to actually keep their mortgage payments paid. They're trying to make sure that they're managing everything. And if you're then in a situation where you've got somebody who's not paying their rent and you're not able to sort of to move them out in a timely manner, it can put a lot of stress on people.
And then it goes back to then there's no investors and no rental. It goes back to public housing, which we all know is expensive, and we all know there's a massive wait for public housing in Northern Territory. So the government need these investors to be able to have these private properties available for rent. And if you, like, if you don't pay the rent, someone's got to pay it, and it is the mums and dads who are struggling. Remember, you've got to pay the rates, all those things on top of it, and keep the maintenance up where the tenants don't do that. So it's the average mum and dad investor here who are just trying to invest for the future, because we all stop working sometimes. If you don't build a bit of a nest egg, you rely on the government again.
There seems to also be a bit of a weight on private rentals at the moment as well. I think the latest figures suggested rental vacancies were incredibly low at the moment as well. And to keep with that theme of the comeback capital, if we're trying to get all these people come up for hospo jobs and fruit picking and melon picking as well, and then there was the health workers.
Where are they going to live?
Well, that's the thing at the moment as well, is I've heard figures that, there's big a number of applications coming in for single rental properties at the moment as well. So then the bigger issue here is we're running out of rental properties.
I know of an example in my mind, I'm not going to say it, of course, where a settlement was delayed because the tenant had problems and the previous owner couldn't get the tenant out and the new person wanted it, and so they all got delayed and got put off. And so that's a classic example of making it difficult to invest in the territory. And that happens. It's happening right now.
Attorney General, it is something, though, that you are going to be looking at again?
Oh, we're always looking at it, Katie, yes, and it's something that I've spoken to Quinton and REINT about, and we also have a working group for our Residential Tenancy Act, so getting feedback on the areas and the issues that they're looking at from all different perspectives of the organisations that are involved in that working group. And again, as I mentioned, the modification notice has been amended 3 times. It has changed 3 times, so we're constantly looking at making sure that we're keeping in line what the territory needs.
360 is the week that was. Thanks to DeSilva Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to Mix 104.9's Week That Was, and it is proudly brought to you by DeSilva Hebron Lawyers and broadcasting on 8HA in Alice Springs. And joining me in the studio for the Week That Was, Jared Maley, Selena Rubo and Matt Hepworth. Now, the other big story this week is that of 18 homes in Palmerston, which were found to be structurally inadequate in their design and non-compliant with the Building Code of Australia at the time of construction. Now, this is a devastating story for those 18 homeowners, and the discovery, well, it was after an engineering assessment following reports of defects to the homes, which included movement in flooring, cracked and loose tiles, as well as poor drainage on balcony. But the report found there was no immediate risk to safety unless there's a cyclone, and they would need to be out if there is a cyclone. I spoke to the department on Wednesday, Building Control Director Mark Meldrum, and he did confirm that they became aware of these issues back in 2014. Now, I guess the discussion it has now turned to, why were those people then allowed to stay in the homes during a cyclone if the department was aware back in 2014? I think it's such an incredibly sad situation for those homeowners, because this is your life savings going into the home that you're going to live in.
Yeah, the question is, why is it taking the government so long to act? And my understanding is that some of the approvals to fix some of these houses were made in August last year and nothing's happened. So the whole program is just been delay after delay after delay, and it really has got to stop at someone's feet. And I'm not sure who, is it the government? But someone needs to come out of the Labor government and explain what's happening so these people and other people out there who are building properties or living homes understand what's going to happen if it happens to them.
This is a terrible story, Katie, as you've mentioned. We have 18 families who are affected by this in Palmerston, and it is a really horrible story when we're talking about somebody's life investment and one of the biggest decisions a family in the Territory will ever make or a person in the Territory will ever make in terms of buying a home. So looking at the current situation, and this is an area that my colleague, Minister Eva Lawler, as the Infrastructure Minister, has been acutely aware of in seeing what we can do as government to make sure that this never happens again in the Territory.
Why did it happen? Like I pointed out earlier, why were these homeowners, though, in a situation where if the department knew back in 2014, were they still in those houses, during a cyclone? And, I suppose the question is, where's the duty of care? I don't know.
Well, this is, again, as you mentioned, that date when those homes were completed in 2014 and that structural review that had occurred, and then finding that there were these horrible defects in terms of the infrastructure and, again, concerning safety for these families who are in those homes. So this is something we're looking to rectify and doing it in regards to having immediate action. But again, future-proofing that this can't occur again in the Northern Territory. And I'll just look at in terms of the particular quality standards. Again, this isn't my particular area of expertise, but the National Construction Code and making sure that all of our Territory houses are built to this particular code, but also the Territory's own building reform so we can protect and safeguard investors and families who are putting up their life savings to safe and quality homes in the Territory.
We've had a few of these stories over the last 12 months where residents have discovered that their homes aren't built to code or the right specification, whether it be homes or apartment blocks as well.
Yeah, those blocks.
What I've noticed every time we run these stories is there seems to be almost like a fault in the legislation where the engineer brushes their hands of it and goes, oh, well, we did our part. We did everything right. It's up to the builder. And then the builder says the exact same thing. Oh, no, we did our part right. It's up to the engineers. So there seems to almost like be a gap in the legislation, Selena, where we've got to work out who's responsible, because at the end of the day, it is, if it's not built to code, somewhere between the engenieer and the builder, someone's responsible.
Ultimately, the buck's got to stop with the government. They need to come in, if there is a gap in the legislation, fix it or review it, because like you said, these 90 people spend all their money, because, you know, home or superannuation is cars, probably the three biggest things you buy in your life. And I understand one of these houses might have even been unsold even in this whole situation.
Well, and that's the other thing
sure
that's been raised throughout the week. We'd received a message similar or to that effect as well, and that was one of the questions that I did ask Mark Meldrum throughout the interview, is are we going to be in a situation with these homeowners, do they then need to disclose these faults as well if they are going to be on selling? But also, how on earth, like, you think it's going to be so difficult for them to actually be able to resell those homes if they want to move or if they want to upsize or anything like that? Yeah.
And remember, there's the insurance fund that's managed by the government. When you build, you put money into for this particular occasion. And, you know, these homes have gone through that and have been found to be approved. And how was it taken so long? And if approval was granted in August last year, why is it now almost end of April and nothing's being done with these properties? Why, you know, go back to the government. Why are you dragging the chain? Why is it taking so long? What's the problem?
Katie, it is making sure that we have those building reforms, and it is immediate action that is underway, and I can reassure listeners that it is something that we are working on as a high priority, in particular looking at the harsher penalties that should be for these type of situations and circumstances, and also the longer term future-proofing of ensuring that there are the quality infrastructure builds for homes, but also that we're protected in regards to the responsibilities, as Matt has mentioned, of engineers and builders and those in the construction industry. And we have some amazing businesses in the Northern Territory. This is not to point any fingers, but those processes and making sure that any of those gaps are addressed, and that's work that's underway and doing it very, very strongly.
Since 2014, when's that going to happen? It's all good to talk about it, and can you give us a date of when it's going to happen? Is it this year, next year, the year after? Because people out there are concerned and want to know, when's it going to be a financial, when's it going to be a decision made, when's it going to be fixed by the government?
There has been a National Building Confidence Report, and it's something that the Northern Territory is taking on recommendations for. I know that Minister Lawler is working very strongly in this particular space. So, again, making sure that we're unpicking any of those layers that are uncertain or that have been passed on and previous governments and current government, and making sure that the processes are strong and the measures for consequences and responsibility for our construction industry are also very strong.
We have run out of time. We always do on a Friday morning, and we never run out of things to talk about, that's for sure. Deputy Opposition Leader Gerard Maley, thank you very much for your time this morning. Attorney General Selena Ubo, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks to your listeners.
And Maddie Hepworth, our news director. We'll catch you again very shortly for the local news. Thank you. You're listening to Mix 104.9's 360. That was The Week That Was, brought to you by De Silva Hebron Lawyers, and also broadcasting on 8HA in Alice Springs.